Although Lydia Davis's latest book contains all 198 of the stories that were published in her four earlier collections, it's not the gargantuan volume you might expect. That's because many of her stories don't take up much room, just a sentence or two in some cases. In his review in The New Yorker, James Wood described the collection as, quote, a grand cumulative achievement that combines lucidity, aphoristic brevity, formal originality, sly comedy, metaphysical bleakness, philosophical pressure, and human wisdom. The Collected Stories of Lydia Davis is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased that it brings Ms. Davis to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Glad
to be here. Lucidity, aphoristic brevity, formal originality, sly comedy, metaphysical bleakness, human wisdom. That's an awful lot to jam into even 198 stories.
I know, let alone stories that are only one sentence. I wonder if each word has one of those qualities.
Has having the stories you've published over the past 25 years collected in one volume caused you to look at any of them differently than in the past?
Well, actually, I try not to look at them at all. I like other people to look at them and think about them, and I try to go right on to the next.
Because I have talked to other writers who have had their stories collected, and they've said, you know, when I looked at some of those early ones, I thought, gee, I'd really like to change a sentence here or there. In fact, in some cases, change it totally.
Or take it out, right?
Or fix it up.
Right. Yeah. Some people asked me if I had, you know, taken out some of the weaker stories and so on, but I really give a lot of attention to each story as I work on it. I let it sit for a long time. So by the time it's published in a book, I'm pretty sure of it. So even if I wouldn't do that again now, that particular story, which I wrote in maybe 79 or something, I still stand by it. I'm still loyal to it.
Will readers notice any changes in style or subject matter if they compare the early ones to, for example, the ones that opened this collection from Break It Down, which was published in 1986, to the stories from Varieties of Disturbance, which was published just 3 years ago?
Well, they will, some of the stories. But the tricky part of it is that over the years, with each volume, I've also included not only very new stories, but also stories that were published in a small press edition a long time ago. So you'll get an old story, 30-year-old story, in a very recent book.
Just to confound us?
No, not to confound, but because the earlier stories are unavailable, and I don't really want to republish an old book.
You have this career as writing short stories, although you also have published a novel.
But
some people might recognize your name for other reasons. You won a MacArthur Foundation so-called Genius Award. You're also a highly regarded translator. In fact, you won the 2003 French-American Foundation Translation Prize for Proust's Swan's Way.
Right. Yeah.
The French government has named you a Chevalier of the Order of Arts and Letters.
I loved that. That made me cry when it came in the mail.
What do you do after Proust? I mean, he was arguably the greatest French writer of the last century.
Well, actually, that was going to be my very last translation. I thought I've been doing this for 30 years or however long, and that should be the culmination. But then Viking Penguin asked me if I would do Madame Bovary. And first I said no because I had just finished the Proust. And then they asked me again 2 years later, and I said yes. So I've just finished that.
Well, that novel has been translated many times.
Yes.
Is there still something new to be discovered?
Absolutely, because I kept thinking there wasn't. Well, this one is adequate and that one's adequate because I have 10 or 11 of the translations.
And some by really fine translators.
But the finest ones probably were working at a time when it was acceptable to do a lot of changing of the original text in the 50s. Now I think the turn is more toward being much more faithful to the original. And I don't find Flaubert's famous style in any of the translations. So that's what I've been trying to do.
You would have thought it would be easier to translate French into English in a way that would really give a sense of the original more than Russian into English or Swahili into English.
Probably. I think each has its own difficulties.
You've also done Michel Foucault and Maurice Blanco, and they would have been very different approaches to the language.
Very different, but my whole way of operating is to stay very, very close to the original. So in a way, you don't go wrong. You don't try to transform each one into your own favorite style, but you just follow the original.
I've known a couple of people who've won MacArthur's and then found it very difficult to work for a few years because they didn't have to. They fix up the house or whatever. But you've continued to translate in the years since you won the MacArthur. So I assume you're doing it partly also because you just love doing it.
I do love doing it. And I think it so happened I'd already signed the contract or the agreement to do the work when the MacArthur came. And actually, I was planning to do some terribly difficult high wire act of working in order to support the translation. So working, taking a job in order to do this job, and the MacArthur relieved me of that.
You've said that you find doing translations relaxing.
Yes, because it's a form of writing that isn't as demanding. It's like solving a puzzle.
Well, often poets become translators, and to some degree, isn't your approach to short story writing similar to what poets do?
It's concentrated and slow work. It's not high volume work. So in that sense, probably, yeah.
Well, for example, there are a couple of your stories that are shorter than their titles. There's a story, Example of the Continuing Past Tense in the Hotel Room. And the text is, Your Housekeeper Has Been Shelley.
Right.
Now, that strikes me as something that a poet would have come up with, not a short story.
Well, actually, those very, very short stories, one line plus title, I started writing those when I was translating Proust because I had no time for my own work, number one. And number two, I think I was reacting to these very, very long sentences of his that often take pages. And so I say to myself, all right, try writing something as short as possible, literally.
Well, Proust also spends a lot of time setting things up.
Right.
And you're not setting anything up with one of those really short stories. Somebody jokingly asked me, what do you think, when do you think her stories are finished? When she puts a period at the end of the sentence?
That's right. Actually, the title does set it up. The title is very, very important for the rest of the piece when it's that short.
Well, I get the impression that the rhythm of the language is something that is a key for you.
Yes, in that sense, it's like
poetry
too. Yeah, every word matters a great deal.
But why would they even be called short story? Well, first of all, are they stories, or are they poems, or are they one line something else's?
That's a difficult question. They're not short stories, because I think of a short story as the more traditional form that I started with. So I call them stories just because I can't keep switching and deciding what each one is. And so the definition has to adjust to the word story.
And then there is your novel, which has the ironic title, The End of the Story.
Yes. I didn't come to that right away. I had a list of probably 200 titles before I decided that was the good one.
And how does that apply to the novel?
It figures in two ways. One, it's saying this book is the end of the story it tells. This book is the outcome of the story. And it's also the subject. Okay, this book is about the end of her particular story.
Well, here we have a volume of 198 stories that is the size of a full-size novel.
Right.
Can you imagine going back and writing another novel?
Well, I can, because that would be very different. And I think I'm going to go ahead and write a few long things in addition to the short things.
I understand that you learned German as a child while your family lived for a time in Austria.
Right.
Have you ever considered trying your hand at German translations?
From German, I actually have done some, because as soon as the Proust was over and I had said no to the Madame Bovary, I couldn't stop translating. So I actually decided to broaden out and try Spanish and German and even other languages that I know less well.
And can you just do that? In the end, is it all about writing the English well?
It's very much about writing the English well. And a lot of people do it the other way around. They say, well, if we have a French professor who's expert in the literature, then the translation will be good. Actually, just it's more important to be a good writer. And I know the languages well enough to understand what I'm reading, so I'm not working in the dark there.
But you could never do it the other way around, I'm assuming.
No, no, not even into French. No.
My guest is Lydia Davis. We're talking about her latest book, which is The Collected Stories of Lydia Davis, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Had you always wanted to be a writer?
Yes, from a very early age, although wanted may not be the right word. Maybe I felt I was headed that way, like it or not, and I didn't really begin to enjoy it till I was in my 20s, probably.
Well, it was the family business, wasn't it?
Writing, teaching writing.
Your mother wrote stories that were published in The New Yorker, and your father was a literary critic.
That's right.
The Times, the Partisan Review, the American Scholar, and his stories were also in The New Yorker.
That's right, yeah. He started out wanting to be a fiction writer and slipped into teaching and writing critical work.
So what happened? You over the dinner table, did your parents talk shop?
Oh, absolutely. And not just the dinner table, but you really couldn't talk in front of them without them correcting something. If it was not even on the level of grammar, but style, if you repeated a word awkwardly and if you said something clumsy, or they would pull you up on it, not in a mean way, in a humorous way. But you never lost consciousness of language.
Well, I assume that when you're teaching creative writing at SUNY Albany, you're not doing that to students.
Oh, not when they're talking. I give them a break. But but anything they hand in to me gets every single thing marked. Whether or not it pays off, I don't know.
Is it true that when your father was teaching literature at Harvard, he encouraged Norman Mailer to submit his first short story to the Story magazine?
That's right, yeah. And I guess he won.
And that was before Naked and the Dead.
Oh, yeah. He was just an undergraduate. My father was teaching a composition course, actually.
When you have a student, I mean, can you spot the student who might very well go on to a career in writing?
Yep, that's not hard at all. But I am very reluctant to do the opposite, which is ever tell a student, you know, you don't have a career in writing. Because you can't tell.
When you're translating, I've always wondered about this. Do you learn from the writers you're translating in a way that just reading somebody in a foreign language would not teach you?
Yes, you do, because you're always making these tiny decisions. Someone said that, you know, translating is just millions and millions of tiny, minute decisions.
Same kinds of decisions that the writer made when he or she was putting it down on the page in the first place?
I would say far more, because Proust couldn't have written as much as he had if he had deliberated as much as I did over the choices.
Could you read a bit for us?
Yeah. What I brought with me is not from the book. It's a new story and just kind of a fun one rather than a serious one.
And it's, what, a couple of paragraphs?
It's just one paragraph. A minute and a half, and it's called Handel. I have a problem in my marriage, which is that I simply do not like George Friedrich Handel as much as my husband does. It's a real barrier between us. I am envious of one couple we know, for example, who both love Handel so much they will sometimes fly all the way to Texas just to hear a particular tenor sing a particular part in one of his operas. By now, they have also converted another friend of ours into a lover of Handel. I'm surprised because the last time I talked about music with this friend, what she loved was Hank Williams. All three of them went by train to Washington, D.C. this year to hear Giulio Cesare in Egitto. I prefer the composers of the 19th century, and particularly Dvorak. But I'm pretty open to all sorts of music, and usually if I'm exposed to something long enough, I come to like it. But even though my husband puts on some sort of Handel vocal music almost every night, if I don't say anything to stop him, I have not come to love Handel. Fortunately, I have just found out that there is a therapist not too far from here, in Lenox, Massachusetts, who specializes in Handel therapy, and I'm going to give her a try. My husband does not believe in therapy, And I know he would not go to a Dvorak therapist with me, even if there was one.
I'd imagine that many readers reading something like that assume that you're writing about yourself and your own life in these stories. Many of them include a female narrator struggling to raise a child or to understand her spouse. Does it bother you that readers try to connect a writer's fiction to the incidents of her life?
Not really. I mean, I'm asking for it, you know, if I do write about a translator and so on. There's always a fictional element, if only in the tone of the narrator, who is not me. For example, in this last one, there are several fictional elements, so I feel a little protected.
But people will recognize similar situations in their own lives, because we can never share exactly the other person's tastes, and there's always something that drives us crazy about a particular fondness for. Well, I happen to like Handel more than Dvorak, so
good for you. You'd get on with my husband.
But I prefer Bach to both of them, so right. Mm-hmm. that would also. I don't know. Sometimes we work it out. Sometimes we don't work it out.
That's right. No, I take a situation and I often exaggerate it. So.
Many of your characters are unnamed. Why don't you give them names?
I've tried giving them names, and I think I resist the artificiality of that. Somehow I want them in the neutral space of he and she.
You've said that Beckett was one of your early influences.
Yes.
He might have called his characters A and B.
He might have. Certainly.
If he wasn't calling them Godot or something.
Right. He chose odd names. Kafka also would use initials for math problems involving people.
And what is it about them that you admired? Because I don't see your work as particularly Beckettian.
I think I admire the intensely careful and eccentric use of the English language on the part of Beckett. Phrases like by dint, her little weight had grooved. He just milks the language for everything it's got, and the syntax. He does amazing things with the syntax. And then the bleakness, the bleak humor, I think. And Kafka, completely different reasons. His humility, his lovingness. I can't judge the language quite as closely because he wrote in German.
Mm-hmm. A language that you know, but you don't know well enough. Many people have complained over the years over the inadequacy of the Muir translations of Kafka.
Yes.
But they still remain the standard. That because of copyright reasons?
I don't know what the legal reasons may be. I think what happens is, what happened with the Proust is that the first translation that came here and that people grew to love and were bowled over by became the author. They could not separate it from the author.
Lydia Davis will be speaking with David Means tonight at 7 o'clock at the Russian Samovar. That's at 256 West 52nd Street between Broadway and 8th Avenue. Tickets are $5. Her latest book, The Collected Stories of Lydia Davis, is from Farrar, Straus & Giroux. And we also have the translation of Flaubert's Madame Bovary, one of the greatest works of French literature. Gee, you've done two of the greatest works of French literature.
Yes, I have.
What's left, Montaigne or something?
No, as I say, I'll go to other languages and I'll do very, very short things from now on.
And when is the Madame Bovary coming out?
Late September, the end of September.
Well, thank you so much for being with us to talk about all of those different things that you've been doing. It's been a real pleasure speaking with Lydia Davis.
Thank you.